Welcome to Midcast, an interview series featuring dissenting voices the establishment would rather silence. I'm your host, Munar Mohawish. 2020 has been a heck of a decade. At least, that's what it feels like for millions of Americans and people around the world. The coronavirus pandemic has flipped our world upside down and has been marked by school closures, quarantine, masks, social distancing, long lines at the grocery stores, empty shelves, panic buying, record unemployment, and miles-long breadlines in some states. If anything, coronavirus has lifted the veil to expose the growing inequality in this country, an unfortunate reality in the world's richest nation. As over 40 million Americans filed for unemployment in the last 2 months alone, the pandemic saw a radical transfer of wealth out of the hands of taxpayers and into the hands of billionaires in what is being dubbed the largest taxpayer bailout of the wealthy in American history. Over the same 2 months, quarantine has caused millions of Americans to struggle to put food on the table, while at the same time, the wealth of U.S. billionaires surged a record $485 billion. One of the first journalists to break this story on the surge of billionaire wealth during the pandemic is Alan McLeod, a senior staff writer for Mint Press News. He began investigating how the pandemic became a boon for the ultra-wealthy in early April when he reported that America's billionaires had accrued more wealth in the first 3 weeks of lockdown during the pandemic than they had made in total prior to 1980. And he joined us now to discuss this and more. Alan, thank you for joining us today.
Good to be with you, Munar.
Now, Alan, I suppose in every crisis there is opportunity, and in this case, it's for America's oligarchs. Talk to me about the U.S. billionaire class. Who are they, and how exactly did they profit from this pandemic? Walk us through it.
Sure. Well, I mean, there are 621 billionaires in the U.S. We know a lot of them by name. They're the people who own our favorite sports teams, celebrities, Elon Musk, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, Warren Buffett. We know lots of them. And yes, as you said, they really have been profiting greatly from this pandemic. One group of big businesses that's also been profiting is the military-industrial complex. A lot of people don't know this, but weapons manufacturers are employing more and more people, even through the lockdown. So we saw, for instance, Northrop Grumman advertising to take on 10,000 extra staff by year's end, Raytheon advertising another 2,000 jobs. Lockheed Martin has already recruited 2,500 people to its ranks since the lockdown started and is looking for another 4,500 people. And the reason for that is that the president has declared defense workers as essential businesses. And that's really what he was looking for. He's looking to shore up the American military even as the economy starts failing. Yeah, so people like Jeff Bezos, he is up $34 billion so far in this pandemic. Mark Zuckerberg, the owner of Facebook, is up $25 billion. Bill Gates of Microsoft, he's up $8 billion. Michael Bloomberg, who you might remember from his big money failed presidential campaign, where he spent $1 billion. That was chump change to him, really, and only managed to get 43 delegates in the Democratic presidential run. He's up $12 billion. So he's really totally reversed his fortunes of earlier. How has this happened? Well, a few weeks ago, Trump passed the CARES Act, which was the famous act in which Americans got $1,200 a check sent to them. But hidden in the fine details of it is that this is really a massive giveaway to America's billionaire class. So, for instance, the Joint Committee on Taxation, which is a nonpartisan congressional body, found that after studying the document, they found that 82% of the benefits for all of the tax breaks and incentives that were in the CARES Act would go to the small percentage of people in the United States who make over $1 million a year. In contrast, all these tax cuts and gains are not going to help the vast majority of us who make under $100,000 a year. In fact, only less than 3% of the benefits go to ordinary working or lower middle class people. And I think this is really another example of what the great author Naomi Klein called the shock doctrine, the disaster capitalism. And that's really when governments and other powerful organizations use disasters like pandemics, for instance, to force through legislation which they have been dreaming of doing for years and have, you know, written the documents, written the codes for all of this stuff, and are just really waiting for some sort of terrible catastrophe to push it through. We saw this, for instance, in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. The school system was pretty much privatized overnight and has remained such in such a fashion. In fact, Bill Gates was quite influential in doing that. After 9/11, we saw the Patriot Act forced through Congress and the Senate and became law, which gave government all sorts of powers to spy on its citizens, which it didn't have before. So, while the billionaire class are getting richer, the majority of us are really suffering under the pandemic wherever we are. There has been a great increase in food banks being used. Even though Trump has promised this $1,200 check, very many people have not received theirs. In fact, it will take around 5 months for everybody to get them. And as a result, there's been an explosion in the amount of food banks, the amount of customers at food banks just looking for anything to eat. And this is really highlighting the gross inequality that is now deepening within American and much of world society, where the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting even poorer.
Explain to us what it means for the economy to contract by 40% and how this plays into the transfer of wealth into the hands of billionaires.
Well, you know, there's this old expression that's been around for nearly 100 years in economics. In a depression, property returns to its rightful owners. And what people mean by that is that in depressions, poor people are forced to basically sell off their goods, their assets, at cheaper prices, and they end up in the hands of the rich, the ultra-wealthy class, the Bezoses, the Zuckerbergs, the Buffetts, etc. And that's kind of what we're seeing right now. So people with mortgages are really struggling to make payments. Obviously, people who are renting, we've seen an enormous explosion in rent strikes, not even ones that are collective and organized, but just people simply being unable to pay their way. So in April, we saw around a third of renters in the United States simply couldn't pay their rent. And that's going to transfer up the line to people who maybe own one house and or own two houses and rent the other one out. What it's not going to really harm are the huge housing companies which own thousands of properties, or the huge businesses like Amazon, which can take the dent. But, you know, mom and pop shops who have been forced to close down and don't have delivery businesses, they're really going to struggle. And once we come out of this pandemic, what's going to happen is, I'm afraid to say, I think a lot of these smaller businesses are going to go under. A lot of people in the lower middle class are going to be plunged down into the precariat, as many economists call it, this precarious group of people who live economically, very precarious lives. It's going to be a situation where the rich are going to get richer and the poor are going to get poorer. And this enormous contraction in the economy is like a shock to the system, where the big fish are going to get bigger and the smaller ones are going to die off.
Now, we're talking about the largest radical transfer of wealth out of the hands of taxpayers and into the hands of billionaires. You actually wrote in one of your reports that since 1980, these billionaires' tax obligations decreased by 79%. While most Americans pay an average of 40% of their income in taxes and sometimes more. I mean, why is this happening and how are these billionaires getting away with it?
Yeah, you're right. You know, if a billionaire or a homeless person buys, you know, a pack of cigarettes or some food, they're paying the same amount of tax on the product as they are. But over the past half century, we've really seen corporations and the people who control corporations becoming increasingly political, increasingly politicized and organized. And in the wake of the radicalism of the 1960s, when all sorts of groups were putting their cards on the table, demanding fairer representation from unions to farmers to LGBT people to women to racial minorities, basically the population, the the Chamber of Commerce and other business groups formulated plans on how they were going to deal with this excess of democracy, they called it, in one famous trilateral commission report. And what they did was basically they organized all sorts of organizations like think tanks and business groups to try to pressure the government into deregulating the economy, allowing them to ship jobs overseas and get rid of costly regulations like union protection, environmental regulation, etc. And what we've seen over the past few decades, the 80s and the 90s, is really accelerating, where big businesses create these huge lobbying organizations who effectively bribe government officials all over the world to ease regulations or even write regulations on their behalf, which increase their power, increase their prestige, increase their wealth. And it's this vicious circle where the stronger and more powerful corporations are getting, the more and more the rules benefit them. So the stronger and more powerful they keep getting. And this has led to the situation that we are in now, the post-2008 situation, where literally just a handful of billionaires control more wealth than the bottom 50% of society.
And Alan, I really appreciate you being here with us to explain this to us and break it down, because for many people who are struggling to put food on their table, who have filed for unemployment, it's hard for them to fathom, you know, just how can this happen in the richest country on earth, that, you know, people in the 99% are really struggling to make it. But I guess this is the richest country on earth for the rich, for the oligarchy, for the billionaire class. And I want you to explain how the media plays a role in, you know, talking about these billionaires in such a positive light. I mean, we have people like Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, Michael Bloomberg, you named a few, who are really these like corrupt individuals who the media paints as these philanthropists who are giving back to society. But we know that's not the case. We know that some of these charitable organizations are, you know, have a lot of corruption. And in fact, they're not giving back to society as much as they claim to be. So talk to me about how the media plays a role in all of this.
Yeah, sure. So there's an old expression, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And what we've seen in the last 50 years in media as well is that media companies are increasingly reliant on big businesses to fund their operations. If you think the dollar you pay for your newspaper goes towards everybody's salary and breaks the thing even, you're quite wrong. In fact, newspapers need about 85 to 90% of their income coming from advertising. And that goes up to 100% for a lot of radio, television, and online stuff. So what we have in the situation is that these companies are completely beholden to large transnational corporations, more generally, for advertising. And that really has a powerful effect on the content of their publications. So in media studies, we call this an advertising veto, where big businesses essentially control what goes into a lot of corporate funded news. Big corporations, big media businesses essentially have to compete to create an environment that's most conducive for selling us a load of crap. Now, what that means in practice is that companies will not really want to see things that encourage their readers or their viewers to think critically about the world, to really put their thinking hats on. And the reason is that studies have shown that if you prime people to start really thinking critically, then advertising just simply doesn't work on them. Now, billionaires are now not only pay for media, but often own the media now. So one example is, for instance, Jeff Bezos, who owns the Washington Post, of course. As soon as he bought the Washington Post, the newspaper suddenly started printing an awful lot of pro-Amazon, pro-Whole Foods, pro-Amazon Prime stories, and seemed to never contradict its owner's report. Another one you talked about before is Bill Gates. He has an enormous media empire, even though we don't really think of him as being part of the media. You know, Microsoft has an enormous amount of control of social media and means of communication. But of course, the MS in MSNBC and MSN stands for Microsoft. And not only that, he funds huge, just a myriad of outlets across the world, from The Guardian to the BBC to Le Monde to NBC Universal, NPR. Gates has actually given nearly $50 million to the BBC's one of their action funds. And that really results in quite positive coverage. So we don't tend to see much critical coverage of billionaires, their power, etc. What we do see is often puff pieces where we see, oh, Jeff Bezos has given $1 million to help, for instance, the Australian wildfires. But generally, they don't point out that that $1 million equates to 3 minutes income for Bezos himself. Or if you want to put it another way, somebody who makes $20,000 a year, that would be the equivalent of them giving some charity a dime. That's really not newsworthy. But because these people are so powerful and so influential, those sorts of stories percolate into corporate media. And I think we really have to start thinking about building alternative media, which is not based on corporate sponsorship, but based on crowdfunding, listener-supported news, etc. We just had a great example of this recently, where 11 TV stations were caught repeating word for word an Amazon press release about how generous the company is and how well it's taking care of its employees, keeping them safe. This couldn't be further from the truth. In fact, when you start really looking into the seamy underbelly of Amazon, Jeff Bezos treats his workers terribly. You know, there are stories of Amazon warehouse workers being forced to wear diapers because they can't take bathroom breaks, people collapsing because it's so hot in the warehouses. It's actually cheaper for them to just station an ambulance outside a warehouse and keep in case somebody hits heat stroke than it is to install an air conditioning system. Whole Foods employees were asking for a raise and proper protective equipment because they were rightly essential workers who were dealing with members of the public. But instead, Jeff Bezos decided to give them a t-shirt saying they were heroes instead, and also fired a lot of people who were trying to organize. These are the sorts of important stories that the Fourth Estate really should be critiquing. And in a functioning pluralistic democracy, they would be. But the problem is that just like our government has been captured by the corporate elite, so has our media. And that really reflects in their coverage of inequality, poverty, and COVID-19.
It's quite incredible to think that somebody like Jeff Bezos, who owns Amazon, makes $1 million every 3 minutes, as you just explained, yet the people that are working at Whole Foods and who are packaging everything for these online sales to protect people are now considered essential workers. And a lot of them are making minimum wage and living off of food stamps. I mean, talk to me about essential workers who, for the last 10 years, it's been controversial to even say that these people deserve a living wage. They deserve at least $15 an hour. Talk to me about essential workers in this case.
Well, essential workers are, the clue is in the title, they really are crucial to keeping the economy going. It's interesting that so many people who were denigrated as low pay or low skilled, suddenly in a pandemic, we find out that without them, the economy and society would collapse pretty quickly. You know, if garbage men just disappeared within a week, cities would become almost unlivable, and certainly within a month they would just smell to high heaven. Yet if all the people who worked in Wall Street just disappeared, it's not actually clear whether we'd notice for quite a long time, and there's some argument that the country might actually be better. In terms of Amazon, for instance, a third of their employees who are working full-time right now, supplying us with all the things we need, a third of them in Arizona, for instance, are on food stamps, according to Amazon's own data. So it really shows that there's this barrier between what we think about a society really needing, and who are the people who are really benefiting from it? Billionaires, for instance, a lot of them have just upped and left the United States and have gone to New Zealand or their other tropical islands. A lot of them are taking time off, just yachting around the Mediterranean, taking private jets over there, no worries. There's been a big boom in billionaires buying up bunkers that are really designed to withhold a nuclear attack, but they're also great for pandemics. And unfortunately, we've got this situation where the rich and the poor are increasingly just two different species living two different lifestyles right now. And so as essential workers have to suffer, and so many of them are getting COVID-19, for instance, in the Bronx, where a third or so of the people work in the caring sector, that's where some of the highest levels of COVID-19 infection can be found anywhere in the world. And yet people in Manhattan are getting the disease in nowhere near the same sort of lethality, just because, number one, they're able to shelter in place and work from home. And number two, they can pay people to do their essential work, like buy food, etc. But that's really not open to a lot of essential workers who tend to be quite low paid.
There's obviously a clear disconnect between the billionaire class and working class Americans in the way that they live life and the quality of life. And what's saddened me the most, I think, and what's really just heart-wrenching is just how much hunger is an issue in this country. It's the richest country on earth, yet we see images, especially now during the COVID-19 pandemic, of bread lines stretching miles long in places like California. I mean, this should not be happening in America. And the media rarely talks about hunger as another major issue that we should be addressing in this country. And I know you've reported on the bread lines. Talk to me about hunger in America.
Yeah, sure. So actually, hunger beneath the surface has been a really growing problem in the United States for a number of decades. But it's really been supercharged in the 2010s. And this COVID-19 pandemic has laid it bare for everybody to see. There was one incident I reported on where there was a line of 10,000 cars outside a San Antonio food bank. A lot of those people had to wait up overnight just to get a nondescript box of food. That's how much they were suffering. And it's because people are really broke in the U.S., you know? Like, about half the country is broke, not being able to cover a multiple $100 emergency, like, say, a roof leak, for instance. Well, this is one of those things where people are forced to push back. So many of them have lost their jobs, and now they're relying on food banks. And I talked to a lot of the people who work there, and, you know, they were putting a brave face on it, saying, you know, we're working extra hard, we're taking precautions with our staff. But others did tell me that they'd actually already lost members of their team to the virus. And that's really heartbreaking to hear that in the richest country in world history, there are so many people who can't even, it's the absolutely basic minimum essentials that society needs to function, which is to feed its people. And that's not happening. And yet, as you said, at the same time, there are so many people living in their mansions or their yachts. And, life is pretty much going on as normal for them. And we see that a little bit with the reopening protests. It tends not to be people in the lower classes that are showing up for them. It tends to be people who are saying, you know, I want to go back to having my hair done, or, you know, I want my nails done, etc. Or I want the golf course to open. What they tend to be saying is, actually, I don't want to go back to work. I want other people to go back to work because I'm being inconvenienced by this now. And that's really what's happening in the US. It's this incredible sight where farmers who used to sell to restaurants and stadiums and universities, their supply lines have dried up, and now they're just throwing away hundreds of tons of rotting food every day at the same time as people in cities are literally starving and trying to find some way of making ends meet. And this is such a dangerous cocktail for something bad to happen politically. I don't want to speculate, but this is a very worrying moment in American history.
I don't mean to switch gears here, but it's definitely related to the topic of, the massive gap between the rich and the poor. But right now, the streets of Minneapolis are literally on fire with mass protesters seeking justice for the killing and murder of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. And the media has been focusing on some of the looting that's been taking place. You know, these images have come out of men walking out of Target with like a TV, and they're just like, is like total outrage. Like, if you guys want change, you got to stop looting. Right. And so, but talk to me about the major mass looting taking place by these billionaires. I mean, why isn't the media talking about what's happening with billionaires accruing all of this wealth out of the hands of taxpayers? This is money coming out of, you know, taxpayer money that's going into the hands of billionaires. Why isn't this being described as looting?
I think that's a really important point you brought up. I mean, there obviously is looting going on in Minneapolis just now, but just like with stealing, as we talk about in public life, when we talk about stealing, we never really talk about wage theft, which is vastly bigger than any sort of employee stealing or shoplifting or anything. But that is from the rich stealing from the poor. And so we don't really talk about that because it wouldn't be done to do so. Because, again, as we said, the media are not only funded by the billionaire class, they're also owned by the billionaire class. So they're not just cheerleaders for capitalist corporations. They are actually very often transnational corporations themselves and parts of far bigger machines which span the globe and live for profit. So, as you said, you know, when we talk about looting, we talk about powerless people in a frustrated rage smashing some windows and stealing some, you know, electronics or some food. But we don't talk about the rampant looting of the public treasury, for instance. We don't talk about all the people on Wall Street. Very few of them, almost none of them, went to jail after the 2008 financial crisis, which destroyed the lives of tens of millions of Americans. Millions of people lost their homes. Virtually nobody went to jail for that. And likewise, in 2020, we're seeing this enormous looting of the public purse again. I mean, this Trump CARES Act is the biggest upward transfer of wealth, perhaps in world history. Nobody's really talking about that as looting, but maybe they should. Maybe they should see that as really the sign that society and the social contract is breaking down. And what we're seeing in Minnesota might just be a reflection of that.
Well, in talking about the media coverage of what what real looting is, it seems like organizations like CNN or MSNBC always prop up these establishment Democrats as like saviors of social injustice, right? We know how establishment Republicans feel about poor people and social justice movements, but Democrats pretend to care about socioeconomic injustice and equality. But in fact, most of the establishment Democrats that we know, like Joe Biden, Amy Klobuchar, you know, former President Obama, these are people that are in fact part of the 1%. So talk to me about the farce that is the Democratic Party working in favor of, social justice issues and how the elections have played a role in this. Incredible, incredible, incredible. Alan, I want to take a step back a little bit and go back to talking about these charity organizations that are being set up by these billionaires. I mean, the one that comes to mind, I'm sure like everybody else, is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. These are charitable organizations that claim to be helping, you know, the greater good of society and to pull people out of poverty. But that isn't always the case. So talk to me about these charitable funds and charitable organizations that are set up.
Well, as an outsider, I often see the Democrats and the Republicans as playing this sort of like good cop, bad cop role, where we're supposed to think, you know, one of them is our friend who's really trying to help us. But just like with real good cop, bad cop rules when you're arrested. The good cop is not on your side. The good cop and the bad cop are actually on the same team, and they're against you. So when we talk about Biden, his history is pretty clear about what he represents. I mean, he got into politics by opposing busing in the 70s. He wrote the crime bill, of course. You know, he brags about the Biden crime bill, which sent huge numbers of people, mostly people of color, into jails and prisons across America. He was one of the architects of so many tax cuts, the Obama tax cuts, which again was this huge upward transfer of wealth. He was a key player in many of the wars, for instance, the weapons of mass destruction hoax, which got us into Iraq. Amy Klobuchar, she was trying to convince all the Democrats that she was a Republican. She was tough on crime. She opposed Medicare for all. She opposed minimum wage laws, etc. And, you know, even in 2006, I mean, she was the state prosecutor between 1999 and 2007. And of course, in 2006, Derek Chauvin, the officer that killed George Floyd, actually killed someone else while he was in uniform. And he's gone on to kill many times. Well, he's gone on to have many different sort of incidents and kill again. And yet he was never prosecuted. Actually, Klobuchar has a long history of defending cops, and that's been well documented. And that's kind of blowing up in her face now. Nancy Pelosi, she's one of the, or at least her husband is one of the richest people in California. He owns large stakes in big tech companies like Facebook. And yet she's on all the committees writing these telecommunications acts. You know, you talked about Cuomo. I mean, he's presenting himself very well as this father figure who's keeping us safe. But in fact, his response has been completely absurd. I mean, he's, you know, it's been farcical watching how he, even during a pandemic, he was cutting the hospital budgets of New York. He was doing all sorts of things that were actively harming the country and his city and his state. And as a result, in no small part to him, New York's got one of the worst COVID-19 rates outbreaks in the world. Now Cuomo's talking about partnering with Bill Gates to, quote, revolutionize New York's schools. And what he means by that, and what Bill Gates tends to mean by that, is charter schools, where the state's sponsored school system is essentially turned over to business. We, the public, still pay them to run it, but then they get to try to extract profit out of it. And it's been shown in New Orleans and other places that this does not really lead to very positive outcomes for the pupils, and certainly not the teachers, who are very often fired and then brought back at lower salaries, non-union, etc. But it does represent a great opportunity to make money off the state. And it's really, you know, a fire sale. It's like stripping the copper wiring or the wood and furnishings or something out of house as it's starting to crumble. And that's kind of what I feel like a metaphor is for American society right now. There are people who are just stripping the wealth away as the entire edifice starts to crumble and deteriorate.
I'm really glad we're talking about this, because the media gives a lot of positive attention to these billionaires, especially people like, you know, Kylie Jenner. I remember she was headlined in a magazine, like she's a self-made billionaire. And a lot of these billionaires claim to be self-made, like they started from zero, they started from scratch. And, you know, they worked really, 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 really hard. And that's, you know, they're living the American dream because they worked really hard. But I don't think that's really true. Alan, are these billionaires self-made?
Yeah, I mean, billionaires now have so much money, they really don't know what to do with it. You know, there's only so many houses, there's only so many properties, there's only so many businesses you can actually do things with. So very often they start try to just spend their money in any way, you know, promoting causes that they think are good. And I suppose it is better that billionaires do give money to charity rather than just hoard it for themselves. But when you actually look at a lot of the charitable trusts that are out there, they tend not to give out very much money. And very often you get the impression that a lot of these are kind of tax dodges themselves. But even if they weren't, it is a question for our society whether we really want billionaires to be deciding who gets to eat and what charities are important. You know, surely a lot of these functions would be better. It would be better for all of us if billionaires just paid their way in tax and we democratically decided what to do with that money to help people. Not only that, we have the situation where, you know, a lot of the things that the super wealthy, the upper class are interested in are things like the sort of charities they sponsor, things like opera and ballet and classical music, things like that. I'm certainly saying that there's a place for orchestras and we should have them. But very often, billionaires just seem not to be particularly interested in, you know, homelessness or ending hunger. If Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos wanted to end world hunger, it really wouldn't be that much of a problem for them. They would still be among the richest people in the world, but all they would need to do is give away a few billion dollars a year to certain charities, certain organizations, and that would be the problem solved, and they would be legends forever. But I think it's telling to their mentality and how the system works that no billionaire has ever actually done that. And instead, they are just trying to kind of increase their prestige and wealth by these ostentatious displays of charity, which often, when you start looking at them, are less charitable than you may imagine.
Now, we have to wrap up here, but something that I find really interesting is when I'm online and you get into these arguments with people, when you call out the billionaires like Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates, and they say, you know, why are you so hard on them? They worked really hard for their money. They, you know, they're living the American dream. They started from nothing. They're self-made. Even like Kylie Jenner, she comes from a billionaire family, yet she's being described regularly as a self-made billionaire. Are these billionaires really self-made? Did they really start from scratch, from zero? How did they become billionaires?
Well, the old-fashioned way of making money in this world is to inherit it. And that's generally what these guys have done. A lot of the time, they are in a kind of right place, right time scenario with regards to certain technologies, etc. But when you really look at the richest people in the world, a lot of the time, they're really leeching off the public in terms of technology. So let's take Bill Gates, for instance. He's very often the richest man in the world. I think he's just been overtaken by Jeff Bezos, co-founder of Microsoft. Almost all the technology in computers, the hardware, plus the software, the internet, all of that was developed at public expense in universities like MIT, University of Utah, etc. In the 1940s, 1950s, the military helped as well. 1960s, there was no money to be made whatsoever in these things. And so the public had to bear the cost of the research and the development for decades. And it was really only in the early 80s, with the advent of the personal computer, that these companies could ever, like any private company could ever, like turn a profit in computing. And that's really where you saw people like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs just hop along, where as soon as it was possible to make a profit out of these things, governments started to transfer their technology and just give it to private companies. We see this in the pharmaceutical industry as well, where generally it's the National Institute of Health or other government bodies, universities, etc., that actually do the research and the development for costly drugs, because really it's extremely expensive doing R&D, and that's why private companies don't want to do it. So we've got a model where the public pays the cost of all the research and the development, and then all the profits the private sector takes later on. And that's what we see with Bill Gates. You know, he's been able to develop a monopoly on software. In fact, in the 90s, he was even taken to court and found guilty of developing a monopoly. But by the time that worked its way through the courts, Microsoft and Windows had become so ubiquitous that the fine he was levied, you know, that was probably what he paid for in his celebratory meal. And so Gates has just been able to amass this enormous fortune for his software and his other sorts of media ventures, which really would have been unimaginable even a few decades ago. you know, if we go back to, you know, the mid 19th or 20th century, we really didn't have billionaires in the same way as we do now. And I think that is, we're getting back to how the economy works now, where we've got this sort of a military Keynesianism where, you know, the public does all the research and the development and all the important technological breakthroughs via the military or via universities or via public funds. And then, private companies are allowed to take all of the knowledge that we've developed, taking all the risk ourselves, and then they take all the profits. And Gates, Bezos, and Steve Jobs are great examples of that.
Well, Alan, I really appreciate you being here today. It's been such a treat to host you and to learn from you as you really broke such a complex issue into such simple terms and layman terms and in plain English. So I really appreciate that. I'm sure our listeners appreciated that as well. But that's a wrap for today's Mintcast. Our show is 100% listener supported. So if you want to become a member, you can join us on our Patreon page at Mint Press News. And we will see you next week.